Hey, everyone, if you want to help the writer strike right now, please consider going to the entertainmentcommunityfund.org. And when you make your donation, make sure it's under film and television. This is not a strike fund. This is a fund for people who are affected by the writer's strike, which is still going on. We at Renegade Animation and Renegade Pop Culture stand with the writers and whoever else is going to go on strike in the near future. If you like what we do, please give us a like, a follow, a rating on Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to us. We are everywhere. Also, support our Patreon. That way we can keep doing what we love, and that's talking about animation. And now, on with the show.
What's going on, guys? Welcome to another episode of Renegade Animation on the Renegade Pop Culture Podcast Network. My name is Mike. I'll be your host for this evening. Joining me, as always, is the animation guru himself, Cameron.
Howdy, howdy.
And we have a special guest tonight. We have a very crazy lemur by the name of Bree.
It's a pleasure to be here. I'm so glad as my Apple Watch goes off to kind of finally have the stars align where real life didn't preclude me from kind of joining in. So I am like super stoked to be here because we have quite a bit to talk about.
That's right. We are talking about two similar but kind of different films that happened to be released in the same weekend from DreamWorks and Universal. We have Ruby Gilman, Teenage Kraken, and from Netflix, Rescued from the Cold Dead Hands of Blue Sky Studio, we have Nimona. So first, we're going to talk a little bit about Ruby Gilman, not just the movie, but the weird marketing, lack of marketing, how it's doing at the box office, all of that good stuff. So first of all, has everyone on the panel seen the movie?
I haven't yet, but with the marketing. DreamWorks, yet again, is sort of the red-headed stepchild of Comcast, and honestly, that kind of just makes me sad inside.
I did. I saw it today. Saw it at the earliest screening I could, and was of one of only six people in the theaters.
Yikes.
Yeah. We're going to talk about how this movie got stuck in the worst place at the worst time. Yay. Not really. It's more of a sad yay than a happy yay. So
I also saw it at the very first available screening this afternoon. It was in the second largest screening. It wasn't like completely empty, but it also wasn't a full house either. There was like probably at most like 20, 30 people in there. The road to this film's release, first of all, the fact that it was announced, I think like 3 months before the release date is concerning.
I mean, it might have been even before that. Like, I swear to God, like the first trailer was only like 2 months ago. I mean, I had kind of heard like rumblings of this, but it's kind of disappointing to me that once again, ever since Comcast acquired DreamWorks from Jeffrey Katzenberg a couple of years ago, that Comcast, which is NBC Universal's parent company, seems only interested in, you know, legacy franchises versus original stories, which, I mean, Puss in Boots, The Last Witch didn't do well initially, but it got word of mouth. But it kind of feels like, especially with the announcement that it's going to be on video on demand and presumably Peacock in a couple weeks, that Comcast just has no interest in seeing this movie succeed at all.
So it was like there were rumblings of this movie like way back in December, or at least that's when I first heard about it. And I was like, you know, I have not heard about this movie and I still don't know if it's coming out. And then, yeah, like a few months later, like maybe April or something, when we got our first look at the movie with the teaser. And then a month later, we got a full trailer. And then it got stuck in what is quite possibly the busiest month of animation that I have seen since I started writing about animated films, all the way back in 2015, because counting both limited festival and major theatrical releases, there were seven animated films all in 1 month. that is way too much for 1 month. And unfortunately, it seems like they couldn't push this one into July because Christopher Nolan did not want to play with anyone else in the sandbox.
If you believe rumors, neither does Tom Cruise.
No.
Oh, right. The thing about IMAX is that, like, you really only have screens for about a week, and at least, like, a very limited time. And in the case of Mission Impossible, they literally only have a week until Oppenheimer.
Yeah, so, unfortunately, like, it's weird because animation has been paced out so odd this year because we didn't get our first official theatrical animated film, not counting small releases or the Netflix releases, until April with the Mario movie. And then we go dead within the month of May. And then June was like, okay, we're going to give you Spider-Verse, Elemental, Lonely Castle in the Mirror, Nimona, Ruby Gilman, Deep Sea. And it's like, whoa, slow down, slow down. And then July, it's just like, we're going to give you nothing. I mean, and that's just in terms of animation. July is basically swallowed up by the Barbie, Oppenheimer, and Mission Impossible of the world. So I kind of get it, but still.
Now, I have a question for you as far as the marketing, because oftentimes people will exaggerate when they say, like, a film has no marketing. But what they really mean, at least how I interpret it, is these people are not in the target demographic. So they're probably not watching Nickelodeon, like, more than, like, an hour a day. Or maybe these people don't even have cable, or they use ad block when they're surfing the web. Would you say you were sufficiently exposed to any of these trailers?
Not really. And actually, just coming to the trailer, just to kind of backtrack a bit, I remember I was in my screening of Spider-Verse opening day over in Atmos, and the Ruby Gilman trailer played. And the reaction that I heard from, like, the guy behind me, and this was very audible, is that, wow, this sucks. And honestly, he wasn't wrong. Like, this trailer did the movie absolutely no favors. Like, it was the most basic, milk white, generic trailer you could possibly put out. And the fact that it kind of, at least, you know, from what I've read of the movie, gave most of it away. Like, not obviously the plot twist that happens. Sorry, I read ahead, so I wasn't, like, totally lost. But I'm not saying this movie was going to make $1 billion. In all honesty, it wasn't. But Comcast just fumbled the bag spectacularly and just left this movie to die. Like, not even have, like, a second chance. Like, I thought Strange World was bad because to me that was blatant. But this was like, we literally do not care, and you should feel stupid for caring.
I mean, that's the thing. I think Ruby Gilman, alongside Elemental, you know, two films that came out in the month of June, are the victims of probably some of the worst marketing of the year. Because with Elemental, it focused its point of view on the wrong aspects of it. While Ruby Gilman got, like, the we're going to tell you everything Illumination marketing style, and it doesn't look all that impressive from a story and writing perspective, even though I think this film has a lot of charm to it, but we'll get to that in a moment.
The last one I'll make about the marketing is I don't necessarily blame people for not necessarily being excited for this based on the marketing, but something that has apparently gotten me a lot of heat on Twitter is when I called out, let's be real, animation fans specifically, but I called out a lot of people in our community for not supporting original movies, even though they say they want originality in theaters. Yeah, I got a lot of heat for saying that, specifically in response to early Thursday night previews for the movie. And I wanted to just clarify that when I made that point, it doesn't necessarily mean, like, you have to go and see Ruby Gilman, even though you're not interested. But if this movie doesn't succeed, that hurts the chances of the next original project from any one of these studios, and then so on and so forth. It's not like I'm dying on the hill of this movie specifically, and we will get into our thoughts in a moment, but if you're asking for originality, you have to show up and put your money where your mouth is.
And I saw a lot of ads for this when I was watching my parents' dog this past week. We were watching Hulu, and every other commercial break on Hulu had a Ruby Gilman ad on it. And I saw plenty of ads for this. I saw the trailer every time I saw an animated film in theaters.
Same.
And I've seen it on TV and on like Tubi or like other services, because I know a lot of people like to use ad block, and that could be a thing. And also, marketing is run by the algorithm. So if you're not looking for stuff like Ruby Gilman, then you are not going to get those ads for it, which is a big deal. And it's just like there needs to be a shift in how movies are marketed, because the algorithm is going to do more harm than good. Let's just say that. I mean, botched first impressions notwithstanding, I just don't believe people when I say I saw no marketing for it because of the reasons I just listed. So that's all.
I definitely agree with that. But with all that said, why don't we actually talk about the film itself? Because believe it or not, there actually is a lot to discuss here.
Well, first off, this film is co-directed by Kirk D'Amico, who a lot of people in the animation world should know as one of the co-directors of The Croods from 2013 and the director of 2021's other animated film that pretty much got dropped off and abandoned on Netflix, Vivo. And it's also co-directed by Farron Pearl with her directorial debut. And we follow a shy teenager who discovers that she's part of a legendary royal lineage of mythical sea krakens, and that her destiny in the depths of the ocean is bigger than she ever dreamed. I want to talk about the animation first, because while everyone is, of course, rightfully gushing about how the bad guys and Puss in Boots: The Last Wish looked, Ruby Gilman has probably some of my favorite character animation and some of my favorite visuals of the year so far. This rubbery, rubber hose, noodly Adventure Time style animation works wonderful in CGI. And we were just talking about a film recently called Deep Sea that had very much the same super noodly cartoony expressiveness. And I am never going to get over that little shot of Ruby Gilman, like, upside down in her chair as she reaches for something. The distance they go with her animation makes her an extremely likable character to follow. And just how she squashes and stretches her limbs everywhere. Everyone in general, especially the uncle who's played by, and I forgot he was going to be in this movie, Sam Richardson, who takes all of that cartoony, blobby animation and just rolls with it, with everything that he does. It's a cool looking movie, and the texture work is amazing, especially on the Jabuki Young White's character's hair. Looks amazing. And all the designs have these cool kind of Fleischer era looks to everyone.
I can kind of see that,
like that Popeye look. It's like Popeye for the modern era. And I love that seaside town that they live in. It's like a pop art take on, like, if you've ever been to Carmel in California, just a nice seaside town where it's just like beautiful, lush green scenery and just ocean for miles. It looks like that, but with like the vibrant colors of like modern pop art and such.
When we talk about the lighting too, because that's something that I've kind of noticed in most recent DreamWorks films, that they really like to play with like bioluminescence and all of the scenes that take place underwater, where, you know, Ruby first kind of discovers her abilities, is just some of the coolest things I've seen on the big screen.
It's a gorgeous looking movie. And I know it's not the stylized comic bookness of Across the Spider-Verse or the absurdly unreal texture work that went into something like Elemental. But to say that Ruby Gilman looks lesser than the other films that were released this month is silly, just on a visual take alone.
I like totally agree. I mean, I'm still planning on seeing Ruby, but the animation style is absolutely charming. And honestly, I feel like, you know, all these animated films that are doing like more cartoony stuff and that we're kind of finally getting away from like, oh, everything has to be like this photo real. Look at what we can do with our like renderers. I'm like, not everything about CG is like how it could be the most real. It's about how you play with it. And it's just kind of funny that we're having kind of this resurgence of like the Fleischer era rubber hose animation between this and Unicorn from Genndy Tartakovsky. And then I was just thinking, because you said Shibuki, like, I feel so bad for the dude between him and like Strange World, like Zuko is not catching a break at all.
He's caught into precarious animated features.
It doesn't help that, like, as much as I like his character, he doesn't do a whole lot in this movie. He's the item of desire for Ruby Gilman. And not to say that, like, oh, this is a tragedy, because I like his character, just this low-key, chill individual. He's cool. I like him. But he's not in the movie a whole lot. But I get it. But still, I just like how a lot of the characters look and how they move and react to everything. The marketing does actually hide one character that I was surprised by, and that's Will Forte's character, the sea captain, who, well, first of all, loved a little detail of instead of a parrot, he has a little crab on his shoulder. Super fun. I love that tour bus that he takes, just how it looks like a ship. And when he first meets Ruby in the film, or at least when the audience meets these two characters, I love how when he looks down suspiciously at Ruby, how the ship leans down with him and then goes back up when he's just like, okay, back to the tour. I think Will Forte is just a riot in this movie. And I know the last time we've talked about him, I mean, I'm sure it was on a show, but I think film-wise, one of the last times we talked about him was when we talked about Scoob back in 2020 and how he was entirely miscast in that movie. But here, I thought he was a riot as his paranoid sea captain who wants to take down the Kraken and has like this bitter, fraught relationship with his pet crab.
Captain Gordon Lighthouse. I'm going to assume that's a reference to the late Gordon Lightfoot folk artist. I loved his character. I love the just completely unhinged performance that Forte gives this character. I also just love his dynamic with the rest of Ruby's family, like her dad and little brother Sam. Oh yeah, and Uncle Brill.
A lot of this movie is elevated. Like whatever problems you have with the story or the writing, the cast, while of course filled with celebrities and of course we're not going to have that whole discussion right now of voice actors versus celebrity casting and what have you. But at least you have actors who have personality with their voices. Because you have Lena Condor, who everyone probably has seen from To All the Boys I've Loved Before film series on Netflix, as Ruby Gilman. And I love this shy, nervous wreck that she puts into Ruby Gilman. And she makes her so delightful. And Jane Fonda as Grandmama is super sassy and just kind of cynical. And Toni Collette and Colman Domingo as Agatha Gilman and Arthur Gilman. Super fun parents. I love how proactive they are in the story instead of getting left to the sidelines.
Yeah.
I think that's a thing that's been improving a lot with animation these days where they have more proactive parents. It, like, that was a bright spot in Onward, where the two brothers' mom was in the plot more often and not just in the background. And anytime you can put Toni Collette and Colman Domingo together, I'm down. I will watch that rom-com or drama or action movie. Make it happen. I'll watch whatever they are in. I do find it funny that we are also in a month where I feel like precocious little boy characters aren't really all that important to the plot. Though granted, Sam Gilman, who's voiced by Blue Jackman, does a better job with the character and making him more interesting than that little Earth Elemental in Elemental.
Oh, God.
But that's also because Sam is more involved with the plot and not just, hey, I'm the wacky little brother. Whoa. Even like the side characters like Ruby's friend group are more within the wrapping of the plot, with them voiced by Liza Koshy, Eduardo Franco, and Ramona Young, who are, I love that little chaotic powder keg of friends right there.
There's a couple characters that remind me a bit of characters from The Ghost and Molly McGee. I think Sam and Daryl would be like the best of friends. And Bliss is kind of like the goth version of Libby. The supporting cast in this film, they are a lot of fun.
And of course, we can't talk about this movie without the very self-absorbed, egocentric Chelsea Vanderzee, which is, how did she describe her name? It was like, it's Polish. And then someone in the background said, wow, that's exotic. And she's voiced by Annie Murphy, who brings out the exact kind of drama queen, like snarky, self-absorbed energy that you would want with someone like this. I know some people were saying this is very much in the same vein as Pixar's Turning Red, and also a slight cheap jab at The Little Mermaid because of how Chelsea looks like a very Gen X version of Ariel from The Little Mermaid. But I don't believe it as a total jab at The Little Mermaid, which came out this month also. Like, golly, a lot of movies came out this month. But still, like, I like her as a villain until we get to a certain point.
We'll get there in a second, but I will say Annie Murphy gave the right performance for this character, whom honestly reminds me a lot more of like a character from Mean Girls than Ariel. Just because she has red hair doesn't necessarily mean they're poking fun at the Little Mermaid. It could just be a coincidence.
It technically, like, I feel like DreamWorks jab at the Little Mermaid was like the opening scene of Shrek 2, where Fiona just yeets or made it to the sea and it gets eaten by sharks. But no, Chelsea, at least from the couple of clips I've seen, total like Regina George energy. And I just love the voice performance. Like, it's total scene chewing and I am totally here for it.
A lot of the plot of this film, I feel like, is like part of its strength and its weakness in some regards. Because there's a lot of ways you can take this story and the metaphors. Because one, the whole Turning Red comparison with the whole puberty aspect of like, oh, she's a teenager and she finds out that she's going to be, as she says in the movie, like, for the longest time, I thought the prom was going to be the biggest deal in the world. But now I have this situation going on and that just takes over everything. And I could kind of see that. I don't fully believe in the puberty symbolism. I kind of see it in either a literal and metaphorical fish out of water story, and maybe a slight hint at an LGBT story, just because of maybe the timing of just, you know, everything else burning down around us via the government. It feels like you could take the themes of it in a lot of different ways, and even like a little bit of Elemental's immigration story, or just like how she argues with her mom about how like she's had to hide how she's different from everyone. And I still love that little detail saying like, I have to walk like I have a spine. When you see the clip of her screaming into her pillow, it's just like, oh no, they have no spines.
That is always my favorite shot in the trailer. Like, she's like screaming into her pillow and her arms are just like flailing all over the place.
And when she like sneaks into her back into her room to hug her dog on her bed, how she just kind of plops down like a batch of noodles. Like, there's a lot of cool stuff, and they do some multimedia stuff, like some 2D elements here and there. And I like the look of the Krakens and the whole recontextualizing the story of the Krakens versus the mermaids. Because for a while, we had, like, the mermaids being, like, this beautiful, elegant angels of the sea. When you read old stories about them, it's like, no, absolutely not. They wanted you to die badly. Even if you watch like the old Peter Pan Disney film where one of them was just like, oh, calm down. We were just trying to drown her. And it's just like, we got away with a lot back then.
Murder is legal because we're hot.
I like how it focuses on like the parents and like the generational divide, which a lot of animated films are doing right now, which I know a lot of people want to say ripoff or copying or cloning or whatever, but a lot of the times it's just timing. I am sure a bunch of studios are all hearing the same ideas or elevator pitches at the same time. That's why we had what, like 4 Bigfoot or Yeti movies, like animated films?
I remember that.
Yeah, like 2018 had Smallfoot, and then 2019 had The Missing Link and Abominable from DreamWorks. So it's like, this happens. And I know that's kind of DreamWorks' kind of ugly history of like, oh, so you're doing Finding Nemo. We're going to do a cool pandering movie with fish like of our own called Shark Tale. And we're going to have Will Smith and Jack Black. And it's not going to be the best thing they ever made.
You know what the sad thing is? Shark Tale isn't anywhere near like the bottom barrel of DreamWorks, because I'm like, especially like the later half of the Katzenberg years, like it got so much worse.
I mean, that's what happened, because like when what was that Disney film that they made during like that struggling years of when they were trying to make CGI films?
The Wild?
Yeah, Wild.
I don't even think it was Disney. I think they bought it from like a third party, like studio.
No, they did. That's what I mean. Like, they were trying to do stuff like without Pixar's help, because that's when the whole contract thing.
Oh yeah, Circle 7, good times.
Yeah, and that's when DreamWorks put out the Madagascar films, which became wildly popular. This stuff is going to happen at all times. Or how many realistic versions are more like loyal to the dark source material fairy tale animated films there are out there? There's a lot, especially when they hit the public domain.
Yeah, well, I mean, and then here's the thing, you know, I'm coming this from a writing perspective. At some point, like, everything's derivative. Like, you're going to be hitting the same points again and again because people are inspired and stuff. Really, the difference to me is what you kind of do for this. And I'm like, at least to me, like, Ruby Gilman probably was never going to be a movie that set the world on fire, but I feel like it does enough different things to make it stand out. I mean, other than, like, the shoddy marketing, it just really came in at, like, the worst possible time. Like, not only for animated films, but just, like, the box office in general. We're just kind of in, like, slightly uncharted waters right now. It really sucks. And just kind of getting back to what Mike said earlier about like supporting original animation, I think that's absolutely true. And I kind of feel like this is the more sinister angle too for why this movie wasn't marketed very well, is NBC, Universal, Comcast, they're not really interested in establishing new IPs. They're more, you know, comfortable having their bread and butter, having their Shreks, having their Trolls, having all that. And they're just interested in, you know, kind of expanding outside of their comfort zone.
Well, I mean, that's true, because with a IP or a recognizable brand or franchise, you have a built-in audience. Though, considering all of the bombs that we've seen with the IPs, like Driven films this month or this year in general, that's changing, but that's beside the point. We'll talk about that all like another time. And they see a movie with no built-in fan base as a risk, and then they just don't know what they're doing. Which is odd because the last third of Ruby Gilman is very familiar. It does a lot of things that a lot of not just animated but live action films do. It turns into like a partial superhero movie by the third act. So
there's one shot in the film that to me reminds me a bit of Dragon Ball Z. But before we get there to address the reveal.
Okay.
I already know what it is.
Granted, you could probably see it within the trailers because those trailers did show off way too much. Granted, they probably had a slashed budget, so they're just like, throw everything on there. Oh my gosh, throw everything on there. And you find out that like as Ruby and Chelsea are becoming friends and doing a whole thing where Ruby ignores her family and her friends and gets this trident that will, as Ruby is told, will either kill Krakens or help bring peace and harmony to the mermaids and the Krakens and just the world of monsters and such. And then Chelsea reveals that she is, in fact, the mermaid queen and is going to kill the remaining Krakens and rule the world. Then it turns into basically a kaiju fight at the end with some superhero flair. This is where the film drops off, or something happened in production, because this is where it really differentiates itself from how Turning Red handles its giant red panda situation at that boy band concerts in that movie, where with Turning Red, it's all about the emotional disconnect and differences that are between the lead and her mom. Here, it's just a superhero thing. Felt like it was the weakest part.
The actual fight between Queen Nerissa and the Gilman family, it was well staged. I enjoyed like the action and how the prom was kind of incorporated in like the background. But just the reveal that Chelsea has been sort of going undercover, taking revenge on Ruby's mother and, you know, doing all that spiel. It's a little bit disappointing because what they were kind of setting up before the reveal was something that I thought was a little bit more interesting. Aside from what the trailer gave away, I thought like they were really going in like a direction of Chelsea and Ruby kind of working together to stop this cycle of violence. But then, no, it just turns out Grandmama has been right this whole time, that mermaids are just vain narcissists out for their own gain, and we got to stop them.
It's so disappointing how it resulted in that, because it then makes what it was, a super special film, end on a very generic note. Like, I could not differentiate the third act fight with what happened with, like, Transformers and such. So, I don't know. It feels like it took off well, and it just didn't quite stick the landing as much as I was hoping for it to be. But that's just my opinion. I'm sure some people like the movie from start to finish, but that last third act definitely takes a lot of the distinct personality that Ruby Gilman had and makes it more forgettable.
And also, just kind of talking about it, it just also kind of makes it seem like dated, even though, you know, we're trying to lean away from, oh, you know, maybe it's not what it seems, you know, we can't keep doing these same beats again and again, you know, kind of like what Disney was doing in the early 2010s, saying, oh, look at how subversive we are, which, you know, and I think to an extent that's actually good. And I feel like having a balance between, you know, having, you know, traditional and then having more in-depth storytelling, like that is super important. I just, from everything I've seen it and heard, this movie definitely, at least with the third act, has a clear tonal problem. I don't know if it was studio notes or like what happened, but yeah, I agree. It's kind of disappointing that we have something, like, I'm not even saying that, you know, oh, saw from, like, Twitter, everyone was, like, shipping, like, Chelsea and Ruby. I'm like, no, that's bad. He's like, this is toxic. Like, no, this is not healthy at all. Please don't do that. But the point is that I feel like, you know, letting the hate die down, which I kind of feel like what we're going to talk about later from Nimona, I feel handled a lot better than this movie apparently did. But it doesn't make the movie bad. It's just, I feel like with the premise and everything, it could have been a lot more interesting.
I will say this, though. For younger audiences, like those who are in the target demographic who probably are just seeing movies for the first time, I can totally see this, a young, like, 6-year-old or 7-year-old girl latching on to this movie as, like, one of her favorites.
And it's not like this film doesn't do anything to make itself distinct or give itself, like, a vibrant personality. We literally talked about all that. I even love the line from Jane Fonda's character when she offered cookies to Ruby. And she's like, thanks, I had someone make them myself. There's a lot of little jokes like that. There's even some dark humor with Brill, like when they launch the harpoon into the air and it lands right into Brill's head. It looks like it almost kind of kills him. And then they're just like, oh, don't worry. We call him Old Buckethead because he's not that bright, but he takes a lot of hits. Like, there's these little moments that gives it a bit more of an edge. Or like when they're talking about the whole video footage of the Kraken being seen by all the, like, everyone. Trevin, his character, like, again, voiced by Eduardo Franco, was just like, oh yeah, no, I showed it to everyone on my video game streams. And how many people saw that? 124. Oh, thank God. 1,000. And I don't know, it's like there's a lot going on with this movie. It reminds me a lot of Brave from 2012.
Oh my God, I could say so many things about Brave. Like, that movie just makes me perpetually angry.
Like, well, it reminds me of that regards because it sets up something that it feels like it was going to be more distinct, and then it drops off into something more generic, and then it picks back up into being more interesting. And that's how I feel about this one. It starts from the beginning to the middle as something unique and different. And then the third act kind of brings it all back down to something more, I guess, palatable for audiences, even though we'd literally just went through Across the Spider-Verse, which ends and has a story that is way more challenging than most animated films are willing to tackle. So barring all of the unfortunate news about Across the Spider-Verse aside and such. But the point is, like, right now, whether it's an IP or an original story, the experience and the storytelling need to be just as good as the visuals, or else people are going to fall off. I mean, that's what happened with Strange World to me. I love the ideas of the generational divide and the whole twist of the inner world or pulp sci-fi world and tone of that movie took place on a giant turtle, and how the creatures were all like the inner, like, security system and blood cells and what have you. It's just the writing wasn't there. So that's how I feel about this. And yeah, it really doesn't help that this film came out the same weekend as Nimona, which has a way more challenging and powerful story and message about discrimination and taking down a corrupt system. But we'll get to that in a moment. But I still like this movie. I think I prefer Elemental more, just in terms of character dynamics and as a story. But I still like Ruby Gilman, and I still think people should absolutely go see it and support it if they are interested in it.
I kind of agree that Elemental is higher on my list because the positives in Elemental are a bit more consistent, while Ruby Gilman does take a dip once we get to the big reveal. But I would still definitely recommend it for anyone who is interested or just really wants to support anything that DreamWorks puts out in theaters.
It's just a bummer that I kind of called last year with Everything Everywhere All at Once, and how that movie being an original IP, how it was kind of like the odd one out of it being so successful, because I mean, this is way before we realized, like, oh, big IP tentpole films are not doing well right now. I feel more justified as time goes on that people are just not showing up for original movies. And there's, of course, a ton of reasons to talk about this point, where going to the movies is stupidly expensive. It's ridiculous how much a ticket can cost, and then that's not counting all the snacks and what have you, how much time it takes to get to a movie theater if you don't live near one, or how there's just way too much out there and not a lot of people go to the movies a whole lot, unlike a lot of us who love movies, who go once or twice or three times a week. It's just like, go support original films, because it would suck if they just all had to end up on just streaming, or they're just too rare of an occurrence for them to, like, not be made as consistently as a licensed property.
Well said. So I guess now we'll move on to a surprise hit on Netflix. Like,
a very pleasant surprise.
Yeah.
I mean, like, the story of Nimona is just so wild. It was supposed to be the next Blue Sky movie, and then Disney in 2021 was just like, I don't know why we need a third animation branch. Let's shut that down, because we're smart, apparently, when they're not.
Honestly, I kind of feel like the whole, like, saga, this, I actually made notes of it, because honestly, the whole Blue Sky story, because I feel like the story of Nimona, you kind of have to tell the story of Blue Sky and 20th Century Fox, because it, you kind of can't divorce it from it.
No, you can't.
All right, so to how we got to where we were in 2021 and Disney shutting Blue Sky down, you kind of have to, let's just go back like a decade or so. Blue Sky does its first film in 2002, Ice Age, which Fox didn't think it was going to do well. It was a surprise hit. And if you know anything about Fox's history with the animation studios, that just kind of accelerated it a little bit. And then Ice Age was kind of both the best and absolute worst thing that could have happened to Blue Sky, because Fox just saw a franchise, and then Blue Sky, you know, and this was kind of on animation Twitter too. I mean, because before like the Mona, I mean, Blue Sky was kind of a joke as like, it's the Ice Age studio, which, I mean, to an extent that was accurate, because I'm like, holy crap, because if you look at the filmography, that you have like five Ice Age films like within a decade, which is insane to think about. Like, when have you ever had like five films of like anything within that close of a period of time? Like, that's honestly nuts. And then if you kind of break it down even further, like if you look at Blue Sky's filmography from like 2002 to like 2012, if we're not counting like the original Ice Age, like 4 out of 7 of their feature films released in that period were completely based off of IP. So Blue Sky never was able to form that much of an identity. And then Mike Cameron, I wanted to kind of cut you in, because we kind of have to talk about that, and then we kind of go to where it really starts to go downhill from like 2013 on.
Yeah, going from 2002 to 2012, you have 4 Ice Age movies, then you have robots, then you have the Dr. Seuss adaptation of Fortune Hears a Who, then you have the one original movie, or I think it's original, I don't remember if it's based off of a book or not, Rio.
Robots is technically an original story. Yeah, William Joyce is involved, but I believe what had originally happened, William Joyce and Blue Sky had gotten involved with an adaptation of one of his books that fell through, and then they kind of made robots. And for those of you who don't know, William Joyce also helped co-develop Roly Poly Oly. So if you're old like me, you probably remember that show.
That's why the robots look like that. Oh my God.
Yep.
That makes so much sense to me now. Oh my goodness. Sorry. That just kind of like that comparison, just like, wow, okay.
That was your eureka moment.
Yeah. And then we go from 2013 and onward, we have Epic, which is...
which is also William Joyce, which this poor guy just can, like Jabuki, cannot catch a break between that and Rise of the Guardians, like just Jesus Christ.
And then we had Rio 2. And then we saw like a little bit of a shift with the Peanuts movie with a super experimental visual style, which actually mimics the comics of the Peanuts franchise. And yeah, I know a lot of people want to put Into the Spider-Verse as the one that broke through to tell studios that you can do this. But films like Rio and The Tale of Despero, I don't know if anybody remembers that one, but...
I vaguely remember that.
There were films back then that were experimenting with different visual styles. They just didn't quite work because of the limitations of the technology at the time. But the Peanuts movie was like that one little bright spot of like, oh, we're about to head into something special. Because then after that, we got like the Captain Underpants movie and then Into the Spider-Verse, which exploded into what we have now. And then we got Ice Age Collision Course.
And Collision Course, because I feel like both the Peanuts movie, I'm like keep reiterating this. The Peanuts movie was never going to make $1 billion, but I feel like it did underperform. I mean, you never know why movies don't work. I mean, it could have been 2015, you know, the Peanuts were a little too kind, you know, for our cynical age. But the Peanuts movie cost like almost $100 million to make, and it only made, what, like $246 million? And then it gets worse from here, which, again, kind of ties in the Mona. And this is like where the real kiss of death, the extinction event, if you will, happens. The next Ice Age film, it bombs, and it bombs hard.
And then Ferdinand doesn't do well, and like, yes, I wasn't super in love with it, but I found myself watching Ferdinand, and I was like, they're really onto something here. This is really good. Do I agree with its Oscar nomination? That's a discussion for another time, but I get it. And then Spies in Disguise was like, really good, really interesting, and really challenging despite its goofy antics. And then Nimona was supposed to be next. And then we almost never got it because Disney was bleeding money so hard, so fast. And they, for some reason, tried to think that cutting Blue Sky mid-production, or I mean, the notes on whether, like, how long in production Nimona was in before they had to completely shift to a different studio is kind of up in the air. Some say 50, some say 75%, but it's a bummer with what happened. And then we got that one little bright spot with Netflix in 2022 saying, guess what movie we just saved? We're going to get Nimona finished. And then the whole world was just like, yes, 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 yes. And then Netflix started canceling everything under the sun.
I mean, the real hero here is Annapurna Pictures, which, by the way, like, I know everyone talks A24, but Annapurna is, like, so criminally underrated. And it, just to kind of go back, I'm not saying Disney was right. They weren't. But from a business perspective, like, I can almost see where they're coming from. So Blue Sky's, like, last four movies prior to that had either vastly underperformed or were straight-up bombs. So under the circumstances, it was kind of reasonable to think Nimona probably wasn't going to do great. And if you saw how they marketed Spies in Disguise, they probably weren't going to help that movie.
Well, they also placed it in the same month as the... Well, even though it wasn't a great movie, but it was released the same month, almost maybe the same week, as the last Star Wars movie.
Spies in Disguise was on Christmas Day. The week before was Rise of Skywalker.
What I call the rise of discourse.
Yeah. But now we have Nimona, and oh my gosh, it's so good. It is so good. It has the same directors as Spies in Disguise, Troy Kwane and Nick Bruno, who I think, you know, did a great job with Spies in Disguise. And I think like an entirely different animation studio had to finish up Nimona. I forgot.
DMEG Animation.
Yeah, which is a branch of the... I think it was originally a visual effects studio.
Yep. They're spun off from an Indian VFX company called Prime Focus.
As we will talk about with this movie, I'm sure Disney wanting to save a few extra pennies was not the only reason why they wanted to cancel this movie.
Oh, yeah.
Because boy howdy does Disney like to try to act like they are the family-friendly company that they are. Which they are not. Even if they make something you like, they have some really terrible politics, y'all. So let's talk about Nimona, because I mean it's time. So it's based off of the comic by N.D. Stevenson, who a lot of animation fans would know as like the showrunner of the She-Ra series on Netflix, which is really good. And I hope that Lumberjanes series is still happening at Max, but knowing Warner Brothers Discovery, they're probably just on fire right now. So, and well, they're
literally
still, yeah. Oh God, I forgot about that. Anyway, so we follow a knight or a new recruit to these elite knights in this futuristic sci-fi fantasy kingdom named Ballister Boldheart, voiced by Riz Ahmed, who, while getting knighted, is framed for killing the queen and gets his arm lopped off by his longtime friend and lover, Ambrosius Goldenloin, who's voiced by Eugene Lee Yang. And while hiding away from the world, Ballister encounters one of the best characters of the year, Nimona, voiced by Chloe Grace Moretz, and they go on an adventure to clear Ballister's name and to find out who actually set up everything for the queen to be killed.
Can I just say something first off? I absolutely love this voice cast, and even though it was like super limited, you know, for all you She-Ra fans, I'm so glad Lorraine Toussaint was in it. I was like, there she is. And if those of you don't know, Lorraine Toussaint voiced Shadow Weaver. And then one of my other favorite actresses from American Horror Story and
Frances Conroy.
Frances Conroy. I was going to say McConroy, but like, no, that's not right. And anyway, I was just expecting like Emma Roberts just to like pop out of the shadow saying, "Surprise, bitch. You thought you saw the last of me." But anyway, this voice cast, it slaps. I know celebrity voice casting, you know, is a touchy subject, but man, everyone just hit it out of the park here.
I mean, yeah, we got Riz Ahmed, who has done a lot of voice work before and does a great job. And Chloe is just on fire. This was the type of chaotic goblin mode chaos maker that we needed her to be with Wednesday Addams in the Addams Family films. So this was like, sorry that those movies neutered a delightfully sinister character. Let's put everything into that with Nimona. And then we also have some small cameos from RuPaul and India Moore, who I think play those newscasters.
Yep.
And then Julio Torres plays the squire that they encounter, with Sarah Sherman playing the car dealer. But then we have the sinister, himbo-ish right hand to Frances Conroy's character, who's played by Beck Bennett, who has been on fire recently with his voice work from DuckTales to The Mitchells versus the Machines. He has precise comedic timing. I have laughed so many times with my ribs hurting in this movie because of Beck Bennett.
He's that character that you love to hate. Some of his best moments are basically whenever he gets his comeuppance.
Yeah, he plays Sir Thaddeus Sherblade. And some of my favorite moments include when he's just like talking to Ballister, where he's like, hey man, I know you're not really like us and I've treated you like garbage and such. And then he pauses and they're like, and? And he's like, what? That's all I had to say. Or when they're talking about like, say like, well, you were there. Ballister got away on that fat unicorn. And it's like, a rhinoceros. It's like, it wasn't a rhinoceros. Are you saying you don't know what a rhinoceros is? If I said I knew what a rhinoceros is, I would tell you that I saw a rhinoceros. And he like misspells that whole thing. And was just like, and he's really fixated on the fact that Nimona turned into a whale. Because there's that, they throw in a slight little joke, like at the end of the second act, when they're surrounded and such. And you hear him say, like, arrest them before the whale arrives. He's that cocky jock-like character who thinks he's the baddest boy in town. But when faced with actual danger and threats, will run away with his tail between his legs. But the real core of why this movie works is Ballister and Nimona's dynamic. Ballister just wants to clear his name in the most... like, I don't want anyone to get hurt, and I don't want to die or get arrested as possible. While Nimona is just like, I want to kill some people.
She is probably one of the few protagonists who is complete chaotic neutral.
Very much so. And I love when they're escaping after that first time, and you see that whole room of just like either dead or knocked out guards. And she was just like, they were there like that when I got here. It's like, uh-huh, sure they were. They are just adorable together. I love that there's, well, first of all, hooray for all of the LGBT representation here. And not just hand-wavy nonsense that, like, Disney likes to do with their movies. But, like, actual, no other way to look at it. Gay representation and non-binary representation.
This movie is gay with a capital G. And I love it.
Yeah, it is just so unapologetically queer. And it just, between like this and then, you know, if you want to read it that way, but I think it's kind of impossible not to read it that way, the Gwen story, which that's more of like an allegory, but this right here, this is like so unapologetically queer that no matter of editing in the world can kind of divorce it from that.
It's all about a story of facing discrimination, which it's a powerful story that people are really connected to right now because of everything else going on in the world right now. And feeling like you have the entire world against you in a system that will not let you win. And I love that Nimona calls out Ballister saying like, oh, it's just the queen. That's the only problem. And it's just like, Nimona really hammers it home. It's not just one person. It's an entire system that is corrupt. And no other animated film from a major studio is ever, like, it seems like they are never willing to actually go the distance to actually call that part out.
This goes above and beyond to actually call out that it's not just one person who we have to take down. It's like, we have to burn down the entire institution.
Which is why I thought they were going to do that in Frozen 2 before they just, like...
chickened out?
Yeah, they chickened out hard. They literally set all that up to chicken out because they didn't want to alienate anyone, which is why that movie blows in so many regards. I've seen the documentary. I kind of like the movie, but that's beside the point. My point is... they were willing to actually take the extra steps to say the system is corrupt. We need to take it down bit by bit by bit. And that's what's so cool about the story and the characters, because of like, you can definitely take a lot of different angles and perspectives with Nimona and Ballister's dynamic and chemistry, because Ballister, even if we didn't know about him being gay, which is very early on, he was an outsider. He was not born of wealth. So everyone's just like, oh, well, how dare he not have an easy ticket to the top like we do? And it's just so cool that this movie actually goes the distance.
Brianna, I want to let you go first because there are just like so many different themes with this film, but is there one in particular that you sort of like grasped onto?
You know what? Actually, there is. But before I get to that, I just want to go the tangent that of like how queer this movie is, that the fact that Ballister is gay is like just like a footnote. Like it's like, oh, it's there. It's like not even that important.
I guess we've all seen the movie, so spoilers if anyone's listening to this. I'm sorry you had like 3 days. It's not my problem. With the big reveal of the truth about Glorif, like I felt like that hit home so hard. I mean, because you could really read that relationship between Nimona and Glorif like two ways. I'm like, it's clearly a friendship. I feel like that's what they're originally going for. But, you know, you could read the queer subtexts under that with Nimona, you know, being a monster and not being able to hang with her family. And then you kind of get like the religious community undertones that...
Like the religious allegory, too, of how Nimona was sort of like ostracized by Glorif's entire community just because she's like an outsider.
I mean, you take the LGBT angle of it, and a constant thing about Nimona's character is that she or they, I've heard two different ways of how she identifies herself. Like when anyone says like, who are you? What are you? She's like, I'm Nimona. And she sticks that energy, that proud pride of like, this is who I am. I have no label. And how she can shapeshift. Very much like the queer angle of this movie, like and baked into its DNA. You could not do anything about it.
Again, this movie is like so explicitly queer. So, I mean, you definitely have like the ostracization angle of it, and that how Nimona was betrayed because, you know, they quote unquote couldn't be friends anymore because society said no. But I guess the bigger picture isn't so much the movie, but really this movie and where we are in history and society right now could not be more appropriate in the time that it's happening. Like this movie, it just literally is coming out at the perfect time and a very pivotal moment of where, at least in the United States, where we're kind of heading as a society.
Which is kind of scary to think about because barely even a decade ago, it looked like things were actually heading in like the right direction. And then 2016 happens and I don't think I need to explain where we were.
Mike, how dare you bring politics into a politically charged movie? How dare you? Oh, no. Sorry, I'm just cutting ahead of making fun of all those idiots who think you can separate politics and art, which you can't.
Which, by the way, like, the one argument that always makes me laugh my ass off, pardon my French, is there's this one argument on Twitter where some weeb was convinced that you know, what piece isn't political? I'm like, excuse me?
It's literally about a bunch of pirates dismantling the world government.
How is it?
What are you looking at?
I know. It's like the whole thing, like, oh, watch the anime, you know, where, you know, it's not woke and shit. I'm like,
yes, it is. It's incredibly progressive and left-leaning. And totally on the side of the pirates, even the bad guys. And it's interesting to see how, well, this little detail went around Twitter when the movie came out on Friday. Everyone took notice about the pupils in all the characters' eyes and how if you pay close attention, they change depending on the perspective and who they are with. And it's such a cool little detail in a movie full of cool little details that it's amazing what they were able to do with this animation. So, like, at first when I saw this movie's animation, I was caught off guard a little, but it took very little time for me to get onto its wavelength and to see Nimona. Also, I think alongside Ruby Gilman and the co-lead of Deep Sea, the best character animation of the year so far. I love that little detail of when Nimona meets Ballister for the first time. And she's just like, whoa, robot arm. It's like, did you lose it? And she's like, oh. And you see her eyes go like two different ways slightly. And she's like, did they let you keep the old arm? Just, and of course, the expressive animation with her animal forms are a lot of fun, or when she's like shape-shifted into Ballister to cause that distraction.
Oh my god, I love that scene so much.
I think that scene is so much fun.
And I loved a little joke when she makes them all go the stairs and such, where someone was trying to climb up and the other guy's just like, no, like, stop climbing. Just run up there. Like, stop pushing me. I'm not pushing you. I'm confidently shoving you into the right direction. Or they're like, I got bit by that thing. And it's like, well, what was it? Was it a river otter or a sea otter? Like, I don't know, man. My arm was getting bit. And then they actually follow up with that joke. Saying like, see, that's the thing that bit me. And the guy's like, oh, yeah, no, I understand the confusion. It has the tail of a river otter, but the webbed feet and the point that guy just gets.
I just love that joke because there's like so many layers to it. You know, because you could take it from the angle that Nimona's not conforming, so she just combined like two separate species. But also, it just, I love jokes that are just like insignificant and then they just kind of build up. It's like so dumb, but it's so brilliant.
Oh, yeah. Oh, and shout out to the small penis joke when the whale is crashing through the different floors. And she's like, what is it, cold in here? And then falls through like, it's there for like a split second, but they were able to fit in a dick joke. And oh, kudos to this film's vibrant, expressive, anarchist spirit. I love it.
When she transforms into the shark for the first time, have you ever wondered what it's like to put your head underneath here? It's like, why would I do that? And then she's walking around with her jaw like just wide open.
She's like, come on, you know you've wanted to. It looks like this was a fun movie to animate because they do a lot of dynamic action set pieces. The whole thing of like Nimona shape-shifting leads to a lot of fun sequences. I just loved the animation. I love the cel-shaded comic book look to it.
Yeah, I just wanted to kind of talk about the animation. I know this movie's going to get compared to Spider-Verse, which honestly isn't fair. It has its own kind of vibe going on. I mean, it looks like an illustrated children's book, which I absolutely love. And the thing that I feel like not a lot of people are talking about, but the transition to like what is Blue Sky and what was the other studio is, I literally can't tell. I mean, yeah, it certainly helps that most of the people from Blue Sky did move over, but it's just a flawless transition. Like, unless someone told me, I would never be able to tell in a million years that this was animated by two different studios.
There's also a small Blue Sky Studios Easter egg in the background on a
on the billboard. I saw that. I was like,
yeah, it's like, that guy is not dead. Then we get into, like, the third act. Now, on one little moment, I was like, oh, no, the liar's revealed trope. Ugh. But then, it's the execution that matters. And you get into this super tragic backstory for Nimona. And very much, probably one of the darkest moments in any movie of this year. Like when Nimona turns into that giant monster and causes chaos in the city and was basically like content warning of what I'm about to say, was going to kill herself on the sword of her friend from long ago.
Yep.
Like that's old, man. You got to be careful when you're wanting to do something like that.
I mean, it was like blatant enough because I feel like, because correct me if I'm wrong, didn't Netflix have like a suicide hotline thing at the end of the movie?
They did.
They did. And they had to because of the whole fiasco with 13 Reasons Why, because of that bullish ending in the first season that showed the character killing herself on camera, because usually a lot of that stuff was handled off camera because you don't want to see that. But for the shock value of it all, they showed that. And just the moment of Ballister pushing against her to not end up on a blade, to tell her that she's not alone, that he is there for her. Oh, it's powerful. And I don't even care that the villain is like evil. These people exist, man. They will undercut or get someone killed to get their goal across, no matter who gets in the way.
Something else I want to address, like, I guess one of the reasons why, like, she does kind of like range out and become that kind of shadow monster thing is it feels like sort of a response to all of those years. I think it's like 1,000 years being called a monster. In her head, it's kind of like she's thinking, you know what? Fine. You want to call me a monster? This is what a monster looks like. This movie is not afraid to get dark.
And kind of think about it. Have you guys read the original graphic novel at all?
I'm aware of like the backstory, how this is senior thesis.
Yeah, because I mean, there's a couple of like differences, and I kind of feel like at points the movie goes a little bit darker, but I feel like one of the biggest plot points that's in the graphic novel that does not exist in the movie, ironically enough, is one of the major plot points of the story is that there is a plague.
Gee, I wonder why that was removed.
Well, this is before it happened, but like, ironically, like, the plague almost killed Nimonas in an obtuse way.
I like the ending to the movie where they do take down the villain and that there is actual systemic change within the world and the kingdom. Like, the knights don't come off as imposing. They take down the big defense cannons. They literally open up the world to new ideas, because the whole kingdom was all about the propaganda, painting fear and hate into its citizens. And then at the end, it's like, gee, being open, loving, supportive, and again, open to new ideas and not being a raging bigot can lead to a better life and a better world.
Who knew?
Anyone could have told you that. You shouldn't need a movie to tell you that, but we do, because this world sucks sometimes. It's golly. Like, what a time for this film to come out. Granted, I wish it didn't come out on the last day of Pride Month, but I kind of get it.
Weird timing aside, I think this movie did come out exactly when it needed to.
Yeah, exactly. And it's up there with one of my favorites of the year. Like,
it's definitely top 5 for me. Like, not even a question.
Unless I see some amazing foreign animated films, it's going to be topped, because, like, my top 5 for at least animated films right now are Across the Spider-Verse, Deep Sea, Suzume, Ernest and Celestine 2, and Nimona. Till otherwise, I don't see that changing. And heck, Nimona might actually make it further up on the list, depending on how, the more I think about it, because the more I rewatch Nimona, I notice these little details in the character writing and the jokes and the background, the visuals. It's a highly rewatchable movie while also just being a really good movie.
It's good, and most importantly, it's fun. This is probably like the most fun I've had watching an animated film in a while. As sad and like as cathartic as the movie is, so much of it is just pure unbridled joy.
One thing we haven't talked about yet is the music. And this is...
Oh my God.
This is how I knew that the movie was going to not just be, you know, really good. It was going to be just freaking amazing. So the score is composed by Christopher Beck. I've always been a fan of like his previous work, like on the Frozen films and the first Pitch Perfect. But there's something about this score that just, it spoke to me personally. Maybe it's because I am the metalhead of the group. The Mona's theme really goes hard. I love the song T-Rex by Kayflay. The use of like distorted guitars in the background music during a lot of the action scenes, that's like this movie just has a very punk and metal vibe that just is completely on my level.
Oh, absolutely. And I love the vocalization, who Merritt Lear did the vocalizations. And there was definitely like, sort of like an indie sort of like metric vibe, which oddly enough, there was one of my favorite metric songs were in there. And like half my indie favorites were in there. I was like, wow, this has like half of my Apple Music playlist. I'm like, this film gets me.
Man, the punk rock aesthetic goes from the visuals to the writing to the music. It's so perfectly cohesive. Ah, just love it.
But you know what? This movie and a lot of, I don't want to say children's media because that's kind of like dismissive. But anytime you use Dope St. Jude's Girl Like, use the uncensored version. Come on. You know you want to.
Nomona is just so fun. It's one of those movies you watch that is just, you love movies and it makes you love animation and just cinema. It's not the big award season things that show up at the end of the year. It's movies like Nomona.
My final thoughts are, this is one of those movies that I can't wait to introduce to other people. Like those of us who are like outside of our circle, people who don't necessarily follow animation news like a hawk. These are the people who I want to show Nomona, share my love for this movie and like the passion that everyone who worked on it, immense pride for. Just so excited to share my love for this with everyone.
Watch this movie. Fantastic.
And my final thoughts are, for the love of God, I hope like the Mitchells versus the Machines, this gets a Blu-ray release and an art book. Please, for the love of God, I am renovating my office. I need that art book. Give it to me.
Everyone wants an art book. I saw like so many tweets about that already. And it's like, yeah, give us that art book, Netflix. And give us one for the CBs too. I don't know what the hell was going on there.
I know, which sucks, because I actually met Chris Williams last year, and which, by the way, nicest dude. We need art books for everything. And I'm like, it's easy money. Like, just sell them for $40, $50 a pop. I'm like, come on. It's like, you just print on demand. Like, you have literally nothing to lose but to make us happy.
We didn't get one for Wish Dragon. We didn't get one for The Sea Beast. We didn't get one for Wendell and Wild. That was a big mistake.
Oh yeah, the Wendell and Wild one, not getting our book pissed me off because I love Henry Selick so much.
Yeah. No, but we definitely need one for Nomona. And I know people are just going to be like, well, why don't you just buy the graphic novel? And it's just like, no. Well, I will buy the graphic novel, but that's beside the point.
I actually have the hardcover, which I recommend. It's a lot nicer. The only thing that's like kind of awkward is that it has ND's like dead name. And I'm like, if I ever meet them, I just want to take a Sharpie saying, please fix this so I don't feel weird about it.
Hopefully, if they ever reprint the graphic novel, they will.
I think they just did, but I'm not sure if it's the hardcover because I have like the library edition, which I had like picked up from Amazon. But yeah, I'm like, yeah, just fix that.
I'm gonna like a more up-to-date copy, so I'm not carrying around the dead name. But yeah, congratulations to ND, to DNEG Animation, to the old crew at Blue Sky, to Nick and Troy. Everyone did a spectacular job with this.
Yeah, just woo! Just so happy for this film.
This one was a lot of fun. And Brie, I'm so glad you were able to join us. Before we head out of here, where can people find you online?
Well, if Twitter decides to work, I'm at Crazy Lemur. I'm at Blue Sky. My YouTube channel is the same name. I'm a little Discord gremlin. And on Instagram, I am Lemur's Rule 1. So if you want to see more of like my art stuff and not just my annoying opinions, definitely check that out.
And Cameron, where can everyone find you?
You can find me, well, hopefully I get a Blue Sky invite because I would like one of those because I am sure Twitter is going to burn and die as I edit this podcast.
I'm on Blue Sky. As soon as those cheapos actually give me invites, I will send you one. I will break you out of here. I will get you out of here, screaming at the cat in the window.
But you can find me on Twitter at CamsEyeView. I have my own website called CamsEyeView.biz where I review animated films and shows from around the world called The Other Side of Animation. I also have a Patreon at patreon.com/CamsEyeView. That's where you can find me.
And you guys can find me on Twitter at CaptainK42. You can check out my quick thoughts on letterboxd.com/CoachK42. And you can follow Renegade Pop Culture on Facebook and Twitter at Ren Pop Culture. You can also find us on YouTube, on Podchaser. Subscribe to our Patreon at patreon.com/RenegadePopCulture. Listen to all of our podcasts on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, basically wherever you listen. And last but not least, everything can be found at RenegadePopCulture.com. Need an escape? So do we. That'll do it for this episode of Renegade Animation. We will catch you guys later. Peace out.